Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Ken Miller. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Miller is a medical oncologist specializing in pain and palliative care, and he serves as the Director of the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Clinic. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, we welcome Dr. Francine Foss. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology at Yale Cancer Center and an internationally known expert in the treatment of lymphoma.
Most lymphomas are divided into Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's. So Hodgkin's lymphomas are about 8,500 cases per year in the United States, as opposed to non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, which really comprise the majority of cases. So most of those are B-cell lymphomas. If you look at all non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, 85% of them are of the B-cell type, and only a small minority, or 15%, are T-cell lymphomas. However, if you look overall at the number of lymphomas in the United States, the T-cell lymphomas are about 9,000 cases, as opposed to Hodgkin's, which is 8,500 cases. And, you know, you hear more about Hodgkin's disease than you do about T-cell lymphoma.
Well, I have to say, you know, I'm really glad you brought up the numbers, because, you know, we think of Hodgkin's in a very prominent kind of way, perhaps because it's one of the first types of lymphoma that was cured.
That's right. Hodgkin's disease was cured out in Stanford with radiation and chemotherapy called MOP. And there have been a lot of therapies directed at Hodgkin's lymphoma. And now at the non-Hodgkin's B-cell lymphomas, there are a lot of new therapies that target B-cells. However, T-cells have only recently been recognized, and only recently have we had good therapies for these patients.
So a personal question. How did, you know, because T-cell is less common than B-cell lymphoma, how did you get involved?
I guess because I like to study rare and unusual things. I got involved when I was back at the National Cancer Institute, where we had one of the first programs in T-cell lymphoma. And in fact, it was at that program at the NCI that we first discovered the HTLV-1 virus, which is the virus that causes acute T-cell leukemia. That was done by Dr. Bob Gallo. And at the time, we were looking at other T-cell lymphomas to see if they had a virus as well. And so I got involved very early on in those projects.
So along those lines, I mean, this issue of the viral cause of some cancers is a very important one. Well, you know, what's your finding? Are the T-cell lymphomas, are they caused by a virus? Or for that matter, what causes them? Do you know?
Well, we know that viruses can contribute to B-cell lymphoma, the EBV virus being the most common type. But we also can see EBV virus in various T-cell lymphomas as well. We know that patients who have hepatitis, for instance, can have a higher incidence of lymphoma, and we do find this HTLV-1 virus in T-cell lymphoma, but that's fairly rare in the United States. Other than that, we really don't have any close connection between viruses and T-cell lymphoma.
All right. Now, lymphocytes, which are, I guess, a form of white blood cell, have a certain appearance under the microscope. Can you, under the microscope, tell the difference between what's a T cell and what's a B cell, or how do you know the difference?
It's very difficult to tell, and the only way that we can really know the difference is using surface markers. And these are proteins on the surface of the cells that we have antibodies for. We can look under the microscope, and we can tell whether the patient has a T or a B cell based on looking not only at one, but a whole panel of markers. And the other way we can do it is actually looking at the genes themselves. So we look for either the T-cell receptor for T-cell lymphomas or the immunoglobulin heavy chain for B-cell lymphomas.
All right. Now, with T-cell lymphoma, I guess there's a wide spectrum of how it presents. Sometimes it sounds like it's a skin disease. Other times it's a blood disease. Can you lay that out for us a little bit?
Well, T-cell lymphomas are what I call the promiscuous lymphoma because they can occur in a number of different parts of the body, and they can also masquerade as other diseases. It's not uncommon for us to see patients that have been misdiagnosed, have been diagnosed with autoimmune diseases like arthritis, lupus. Some patients have had hemolytic anemia of unclear etiology, and some patients just come in with fever that they've had for weeks or months. Oftentimes, it's difficult for the primary care doctor to diagnose T-cell lymphoma because in its earliest stages, it can be very difficult to find it. And it's only after these symptoms have manifested themselves for weeks to months that we are actually able to make that diagnosis. And even in cases that I see, sometimes the pathologist will tell me that the diagnosis is very tricky. I think that's an important thing for patients to remember because if you do have one of these lymphomas and you've had these symptoms for weeks or months, it isn't necessarily necessarily that your doctor's made a mistake. It's really that the disease itself likes to masquerade itself as other things.
Now, in the skin, if you have a patient with a T-cell lymphoma affecting the skin, what might you see when you examine that patient?
Well, a lot of T-cell lymphomas like to go to the skin because of characteristics of the cells that make them like to live in the skin. But it's important to remember that even though they're in the skin, they're also possibly in other areas of your body. So you can't trick yourself into thinking that by just treating that skin nodule, you're going to get rid of the disease. We really don't understand why they like to go to the skin. But if you look at all lymphomas that present in the skin, about 80% of them are T-cell lymphomas. There are some B-cell lymphomas that can also do this, and it's important to remember that.
Is there a rash or what?
Well, usually they present as nodules or lumps, but they also can present as a rash. They can look like eczema or psoriasis. They can look like an insect bite. In some cases, we have people come in with a rash that looks like Lyme disease, but it was biopsied and it was shown to be lymphoma.
Interesting. So, by the way, you said two words which I think are really fascinating. One is it's a promiscuous lymphoma, and the second that it masquerades. So I think those are important things to remember. We had an email question from Marcia, who lives in Longmeadow, Massachusetts. And she writes here, my father had a non-Hodgkin's, and then she writes, T-cell lymphoma. Is this genetic, and do I have to worry about it or my children?
We really don't have a lot of good information to support that these lymphomas are genetic. And in fact, we do have some evidence to support the fact that there are environmental factors that contribute to getting these lymphomas. The only hint we have about a potential genetic predilection is that there's been work done here at Yale as part of an international effort to look at various genes in patients to see whether any of those genes predict for whether a patient's ever going to develop a lymphoma in their life. And we've actually picked out a panel of genes that predict for T-cell lymphoma. This work is being done by Dr. Yaoyi Zhang in the epidemiology department at Yale. And in fact, it may be now that by looking at these panels of genes, we can start looking at family members to see if there might potentially be a risk in other folks in a family. But at this point, we really don't feel that these lymphomas, by and large, are genetic.
Now, I mean, if we projected 10, 15, 20 more years into the future, if you know what genes may predict, I mean, how might that help you and help patients eventually?
Well, I think there's two factors here. There's the biological factors, and then there's the environment that we all encounter every day with all of the various chemicals, toxins, and radiation that we're all exposed to. And many of us in the lymphoma feel that there is a contribution of environmental toxins and really the way the body responds to those. So, for instance, if we know that you maybe have a pattern of genes that makes it harder for you to repair DNA damage by these chemicals, for instance, then one might think about a program, a prophylactic or preventive program, for instance, using antioxidants or other substances that might help to protect your DNA. The same way that we think about patients with colon cancer, familial colon cancer, and familial breast cancer, where we know that we need to look in other target organs for other cancers that are associated with those family cancers.
So let me ask you along those lines. Actually, one of my cousins actually has celiac disease or SPRU, which is a bowel disorder. In that case, does a careful diet reduce their risk of his risk of developing lymphoma?
Well, it's unclear, but I think most of us feel that because the disease is stimulated by the gluten in the diet, the more of that gluten that your body's exposed to, the more those T cells are going to be reacting against it. And eventually, if you have lymphocytes, be they T or B cells, that continue to react against a foreign toxin or an antigen, then eventually you're going to select out a clone of cells that will develop into a lymphoma. So I think the answer is yes. If we are careful about the exposure, perhaps we can prevent some of these cancers.
So, all right, let me ask, this is not quite T cell as much as maybe B cell, but the bacteria in the stomach, H. pylori, it's a fascinating story. How is that associated with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and can you cure lymphoma by giving antibiotics?
Well, that's been a really interesting story for those of us in the lymphoma field because what we've learned is that this bacteria infection in the stomach essentially acts like a foreign antigen and it stimulates an immune response, in this case of the B cells. And what happens with that infection sitting there for weeks, months, or years is that the body develops a very brisk reaction and you actually develop a clonal proliferation of B cells, which is our definition of B cell lymphoma. We know that by treating that infection with antibiotics and medications that suppress the acid in the stomach, that actually we can cure patients without even giving them chemotherapy or radiation. So that's really fascinating, and that's gotten us thinking a lot about some of the other things that we're exposed to in our environment. And in fact, you can extrapolate from that to look at some of these lymphomas that actually spontaneously regress. We've seen T-cell and B-cell lymphomas that go away without our doing anything. And perhaps that represents taking away some stimulus for the lymphoma that we don't even know about yet.
Along those lines, I mean, you see so many patients with this unusual, it's not actually not that unusual, but with this type of specific type of lymphoma. Any stories that you can remember just sitting here in terms of patients where actually you saw regression, you know, without chemotherapy?
There was a very interesting story about an elderly Italian gentleman who came in with this huge mass on his scalp. It started as a little tiny nodule, and it got bigger and bigger over about 4 or 5 months, such that it almost covered the entire scalp. He came in to see us. He'd had a biopsy. It showed aggressive T-cell lymphoma, a very aggressive form under the microscope. And so we very quickly rushed him in to get his CAT scans and his bone marrow biopsy and get ready to give him chemotherapy. Well, lo and behold, 2 weeks later when he came in after getting all these scans done, the lesion looked like it had shrunk down by about 50%, and he had done absolutely nothing. And so we decided to do the conservative thing, which is, you know, wait another couple weeks to see what happened. And lo and behold, the lesion completely disappeared, and it's never come back again.
Wow.
So that's an important lesson for us as doctors, you know, that we really need to carefully look at the whole situation and the whole patient before we launch into any therapy.
So, you know, I have to say, it reminds me, one of my mentors years ago used to say, you know, do you know why they call it the practice of medicine? And then she would respond, it's because we're just practicing. So, you know, does that apply to your, you know, sort of what you've learned?
Well, I think that certainly applies to lymphoma because with the exception of the diffuse large B-cell lymphomas, there really isn't any specific treatment paradigm for these diseases. If you look at the low-grade B-cell lymphomas, there are 5 possible treatments. In fact, the NCCN guidelines, which are our kind of national practice guidelines for cancer, they don't give us a specific recommendation. They tell us that there are 5 or 6 things that you can do. And which one you do for a patient, I think, really depends on the patient and the doctor and a number of other factors that are really intangible.
All right. Well, we're going to come back to that in a couple minutes. For now, we're going to take a break. We also encourage you, if you'd like to, please email us if you have questions. And you can email us at canceranswers@yale.edu.
The American Cancer Society estimates that in 2008, there'll be over 62,000 new cases of melanoma in this country, and about 2,400 patients are diagnosed annually here in Connecticut alone. While melanoma accounts for only about 4% of skin cancer cases, it causes the most skin cancer deaths. But when detected early, melanoma is easily treated and highly curable. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for melanoma. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to newly available medicines which have not yet been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Francine, you know, let's say when you see a new patient with a T-cell lymphoma, you know, before we talk about the specific treatments, how do you make decisions in terms of who needs to be treated, who doesn't, what kind of treatment? What's the process?
Well, what we do is we carefully review the history, and of course, we like to review the biopsies, and in many cases, we'll ask for additional tissue so that we can really determine the subtype of T-cell lymphoma. That's very important because if you actually look at the new lymphoma classification system, they've broken T-cell lymphoma up into about 15 or 16 different subtypes, and all of those have slightly different treatments. So the first important thing is making the right diagnosis. The second thing is looking at the overall patient and how far the lymphoma has spread. And so we look in the blood and the bone marrow, and we usually do CAT scans or PET scans. We put all that information together, and we take the general health of the patient into consideration, and then we decide whether the patient should be treated with conventional chemotherapy or radiation therapy, or whether they might be a candidate for one of our investigational studies looking at new ways to approach T-cell lymphoma.
All right, so let me throw out a couple case scenarios. You do all the tests, you do a thorough evaluation, and let's say you find out that it's a relatively young person, let's say we'll call 50 young, because I'm around that age or a little bit older, but at early stage, single nodule or, you know, one area of the skin. How do you approach that?
if that is an aggressive T-cell lymphoma, then we may approach that just by radiating that area. But we keep in the back of our minds that these lymphomas do come back. And in many cases with T-cell lymphoma, they're not really curable. So we have to be very careful about watching what's going to happen next.
All right. So and vice versa, on the other side of the spectrum, a patient, let's say, who presents with very, very advanced T-cell lymphoma with symptoms and with enlarged lymph nodes, and what general approach there?
Well, we know that those patients need aggressive chemotherapy, and in many cases, they need to have four or five chemotherapy drugs given at the same time. We also know that although half of those patients will go into remission, many of them will relapse. And so that's when we really start thinking about more aggressive approaches to potentially cure these patients. And that includes bone marrow transplantation, be it from yourself or from another donor. So we like to start thinking about that earlier rather than later in a disease that we know is going to recur. If we, in fact, have a family donor, then that would be a preferred approach for many of our patients. But there are patients who are older or who have other medical problems or who don't have an identically matched donor. And in that case, we need to think of more creative strategies for them.
All right. For those that are able to have a bone marrow transplant, what is the advantage of that? What's the mechanism by which it works?
Well, there are two types of bone marrow transplant. The autologous transplant is where you give yourself back the cells, and the allogeneic transplant is where you get the cells from somebody else. In the autologous transplant, we like to take the cells from you at a point where we think that your disease is completely in remission, and then we give you very high-dose chemotherapy to try to eradicate any residual tumor cells that are still hiding out in the body, and then we give you your own stem cells back to reconstitute your immune system. And so really, an autologous transplant is super-duper-duper chemotherapy. Whereas the allogeneic transplant has a completely different mechanism. With the allogeneic transplant, we're essentially getting rid of your own immune system using our conditioning therapies, and then we're giving you back a new immune system. We're giving you cells from somebody else, and those cells hopefully will be able to recognize your tumor cells, any residual tumor cells left in your body, and kill them. And so the allogeneic transplant is really immunotherapy, as opposed to the autologous, which I mentioned is really super-duper chemotherapy.
Okay. What are some of the we all talked about antibodies. Do you have antibodies for T-cell lymphoma?
Well, antibodies are very interesting, and really antibodies have completely changed the way we treat lymphomas. An antibody is a molecule that is directed against a protein on the surface of a tumor cell. So in the case of rituximab, for instance, rituximab for B-cell lymphoma targets the CD20 protein, which is expressed on just about every B-cell lymphoma. So these antibodies are part of the body's own immune system. By binding these antibodies to the tumor cells, it helps our immune system to get rid of those tumor cells. So we have rituximab for B-cell lymphoma, and now we've got a number of antibodies for T-cell lymphoma as well, including Campath, which is good not only for T-cell but also for other types of lymphoma. And now we've got some new unique and interesting ones that are still in investigation, such as the anti-CD4 antibody.
All right. So along those lines, a lot of your research has been on a fusion toxin, which was one of the first FDA-approved biological drugs for the treatment of lymphoma. Can you tell us the history of that and what it is?
Right. Well, just like an antibody would bind to a protein on the surface of a tumor cell, a fusion toxin essentially does the same thing. But the fusion toxin is armed with an element such as a toxin that can get into that tumor cell and kill it, whereas the antibody by itself really depends on the immune system to kill the cell. So the ONTAC is a molecule that consists of interleukin-2, which binds to the interleukin-2 receptor, combined with diphtheria toxin. So once that molecule binds to the cell, the diphtheria toxin gets into that tumor cell and it kills the cell. So really, the IL-2 part of it is a carrier. It's a way of delivering that molecule specifically to tumor cells that have the IL-2 receptor.
And when the diphtheria toxin is, in a sense, delivered, almost like a Trojan horse, to the cancer cells, what happens then?
Well, the diphtheria toxin is a very potent toxin, and if you just get one molecule into a cancer cell, it will kill that cell. So it's a very, very effective way of killing cancer cells.
And is the diphtheria toxin delivered to normal cells?
The delivery of diphtheria toxin is very selective based on the IL-2 part of that molecule. So the IL-2 part will deliver it only to cancer cells or cells that have the IL-2 receptor. And in our body, basically, there are only a few circulating T lymphocytes, normal ones, that have the IL-2 receptor. Otherwise, our normal tissues don't. And even though those few normal T cells are targeted by the molecule, they reconstitute themselves very quickly, so it really doesn't have any major impact.
Yes, I mean, it sounds like a wonderful approach to treatment to be able to be that selective. We had an email from Michael, who lives in Groton, actually almost on the other side of the spectrum from very intense therapy. He said, my uncle was just diagnosed with a T-cell lymphoma, and his doctor is recommending a watch-and-wait approach. So, and he wanted to get your opinion on that. I mean, is there a role for careful observation?
Well, I think there's definitely a role in B-cell lymphoma for watch and wait for the low-grade B-cell lymphomas. In T-cell lymphoma, it really depends on the subtype. Many of these patients really do need to go on to therapy. And the nice thing about T-cell lymphoma is that we have a number of oral drugs that are available now. For instance, we have an oral retinoid molecule called targretin that really is a derivative of vitamin A. And we now have the oral HDAC inhibitors. The one that's recently FDA approved is called vorinostat. And this is a biomodulator. It really works by affecting the transcription of genes. And so both the targretin and the Xalinza are really biological therapies, and they're oral, and they don't have a lot of side effects for patients. So these are very nice drugs to use in an early stage patient.
How does targretin is a form of vitamin A? How does that work?
Well, it's a form of vitamin A that's modified slightly chemically so that it binds to cells and it really affects the transcription of various genes, such as genes that turn on cancer cells. So if you can turn off these genes that are driving those cancer cells to divide, then you can essentially put the cancer in remission.
Francine, you're very active as an investigator. What other clinical trials are you working on now?
We're working on a number of different clinical trials for T-cell lymphoma. One of the interests in our group is trying to develop a new therapy for patients when they first come in. And so what we've done is we've taken the conventional chemotherapy called CHOP, and we've added the ONTAC molecule to that. So we're giving combined therapy with the biological agent and chemotherapy when patients first come in. And we know that by doing that about 90% of our patients will have a complete response or a very good response to their chemotherapy. We're also working on a number of drugs that are important for patients who fail chemotherapy, so the second-line agents. And we have a couple of new histone deacetylase inhibitors. One of them is romidepsin, and the other one is belinostat. And these are slightly different from each other, and they both have very significant activity. In addition, we've worked with a couple of other new drugs, such as the pralatrexate, which is a new derivative of methotrexate, a very old drug. Mm-hmm. The pralatrexate has a very high activity in T-cell lymphoma, and hopefully that drug will even be FDA approved this year. And then we're also looking at some new drugs that we think might be active in T-cell lymphoma. One of these drugs is called clofarabine, and another drug is called Treanda, and the Treanda was another drug that was approved this year for B-cell lymphoma. And ultimately, what we'd really like to do is to develop an immunotherapy for T-cell lymphoma. So we're working with some of the basic science groups at Yale to try to hook up various kinds of immune effector genes to targeting genes so that we can, again, selectively get to those lymphoma cells and make the immune system work in our favor.
One of the things you talked about was something called HDAC, or histone deacetylase inhibitors. On a very basic level, for myself and for the listeners as well, can you explain what are histones and what is a deacetylase?
Well, basically, if you look at our chromosomes, our genes are in chromosomes, and the chromosome consists not only of the DNA, but also of proteins called histones that kind of keep that wound up in a really tight coil. We want that DNA to be wound up in a coil most of the time because coiling it up prevents the genes from being made, from being transcribed, and we don't want our chromosomes making all kinds of genes all the time that we don't need. And so the histones are kind of like a protection to essentially silence some of those genes. And we can modify those histones by acetylation or deacetylation, and that process basically allows them to fall off the DNA and allows it to open up so that genes can be transcribed. Now, we know if we look at tumor cells versus normal cells that there's a different pattern of acetylation of those histones, and that if we actually treat tumor cells with these histone deacetylase inhibitors or HDAC inhibitors, that we can cause those histones to fall off the DNA and allow various genes to be transcribed. And some of those genes are genes that are going to turn off the tumor cells. So this is an important process that we only recently learned about. And I really view this as a biological therapy because we're really modifying proteins that are responsible for the gene transcription in the cells.
Again, I'm just going to ask you to make long-term predictions. But the way, you know, sort of the trends that you've seen in oncology, 20, 30, 50 years from now, will these diseases be treated with chemotherapy as we know it now, or do you think it will be more of these biological approaches?
I think the field is really moving toward biological approaches and targeted therapies, because if you think about chemotherapies by and large kill all dividing cells. They're not really specific. And we've learned from years and years and years of giving chemotherapy that it's very difficult to cure more patients that way. We can put patients in remission, but do we really cure more patients? There was recently was a summit where this was discussed on national TV and a Newsweek article that followed up. And the point that was made in that article is that going down that same road with more chemotherapies that look the same isn't really going to help us. And most people feel that the future is really in some of these novel agents, like the antibodies, like the HDAC inhibitors, and like some of these other new targeted therapies that are targeting specific proteins or enzymes that we know are important for tumor cells.
So I have to say, I read that Newsweek article as well, and it was sort of sobering and solemn in its own way. You know, your own experience in treating non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I mean, many years into it, do you feel pessimistic about it or more optimistic about sort of where we've been and where we're going?
Well, I've been treating a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma now for almost 20 years, and I started out at the National Cancer Institute when we thought that giving more chemotherapy was better. So we've evolved considerably from that point. And now what we're doing really is taking a more holistic approach to the whole disease. We're looking at patients, and even if we know that we may not be curing those patients, we have very good drugs and very good strategies to keep their disease in remission and improve the quality of life for those patients. So I think that's one major direction that we're going in. Another direction, I think, is focusing more on immunotherapies and really thinking more about transplant and other immunotherapy approaches for patients. And even though the initial vaccine studies with B-cell lymphoma did not prove to be successful, I think we learned a lot about giving vaccine therapy. And I think the next set of studies, hopefully going in a different direction, will allow us to use immunotherapy more broadly. So I really feel very, very optimistic about the future.
I have to say, listening to you, I feel the same way. Just as we wrap it up, what's available for patients in terms of support groups at Yale and other programs in the community?
Well, Yale has a number of support groups for patients. We have lots of information available through our cancer line where patients can get information about their diseases or how to obtain a second opinion and also how to participate in our support groups. But specifically for lymphoma and leukemia patients, there are a couple of resources that you should know about. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Foundation has a website and a Connecticut office, and the Lymphoma Foundation does as well. So I think it's important to use these resources as well.
Thank you. Anyways, Francine, let me say this has been a wonderful session, so thanks for being with me. For now, I'd like to wish all of you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions for the doctors or would like to share your comments, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. Next week, Ken Miller speaks with Lucinda Hogarty, the program director for the Connecticut Cancer Partnership. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.